The Blue Jackets appear to have righted the ship. Can it last? I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score, 89.7's weekly look at sports. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week we'll talk to an Ohio State beat writer. The team's on a bye, but they're playing their best football right now, and things are looking up for the second half of the season.
And the Cleveland Cavaliers are back in action. They lost to the Golden State Warriors last year in the NBA Finals, but they're back in action here in October. What do they need to do to make a run to the finals again?
But first, the Columbus Blue Jackets had the worst start to a season in the NHL since World War II. They lost their first seven games. That led to the firing of head coach Todd Richards. He was replaced with John Tortorella, who appears to have righted the ship. Tortorella lost his first game but has won the last two. On the line now, Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, has Tortorella righted the ship? Are things on the right track?
Well, I think certain elements of their game has come along. They're playing a more defensively sound game, and I think that starts with the goaltender. Sergei Bobrovsky's been better. I think you're starting to see a little bit of confidence. I still think they're trying to iron some things. They've done a lot of work in the defensive zone, you know, and that was a struggle again for them in New Jersey on Tuesday. They won, but it was by no means pretty, and if they continue to play like that, lots of turnovers from their own blue line back, lots of not smart plays with the puck. A better team probably comes out of the first period. If the Devils were a better team, they'd probably come out of the first period with a two-goal lead, maybe a three-goal lead, and then that's a different game. But Columbus got away with that one. A good sign. I mean, if you start to win games that you don't play well in, that's usually a good sign. And they shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth here with two straight wins. But I think there's an understanding with this team, top to bottom, that they've got to continue to play better.
You mentioned confidence. Tortorella said that was his first goal as head coach, was to restore player confidence. What's he doing? Is he responsible for this boost in confidence?
You know what? I look at it this way. Todd Richards was unanimously respected within the organization. And I mean that. I think all the players liked Todd Richards. They appreciated his hockey know-how. I don't know that fear was part of that respect, if that makes any sense. And I think you get that with John Tortorella. There's a real, you know, when he walks in the room, everybody sort of stands up straight. He's one of those guys for whatever reason, has that presence about him. And it got to the point, and we've said this, where nobody in the building had any answers as to how to fix this. And when that happens, you got to do something drastic. And John Tortorella was there. He's a fantastic coach. There's some baggage with his style of coaching, of course, but they felt like they needed a jolt, and he has provided that in the early going.
They've been able to win the last two games without all-star Ryan Johansson, who's been out with a mysterious illness. That comes after Tortorella benched Johansson at the end of his first game with the Jackets. Should we read any more into that he benches Johansson and then Johansson sits out the next two games, or is that just a coincidence?
I think it's circumstantial. Everything that I've been able to figure out in the story tells me that it's purely circumstantial. We'll see where this goes. I mean, first game under John Tortorella and Johansson's bench for the final 6 minutes. He later told the club that he'd been battling fatigue for more than a week, so they sent him home from Denver to have tests done. I'm not privy to the results of those tests, but I can tell you this, that Johansson is skating with the club today in Columbus and plans to go on the trip to Washington later today where they play the Capitals on Friday.
The Jackets beat New Jersey on Tuesday night. That was despite what Tortorella described as heavy legs because of a hard practice on Monday. And that's from a guy who said he doesn't like morning skates on game days because they wear players out. Is he still kind of feeling out the ground, or is he not sure of his coaching style in that regard about working players too hard, or is there something else to that?
Well, I think it's specific to this group, and he's trying to figure out exactly how hard he can push. What is too hard? He wants to play, as he says, with pace. He wants to go fast. And his thing with morning skates is it's as much about not wasting energy on game days as it is not wasting the emotion of putting the uniform on. And his thing is, whenever you put the uniform on, you should be prepared to go hard. And he pushed them hard in practice before the game in New Jersey the day before, felt like they didn't have much in the tank on Tuesday. And I'll tell you this, too. There's a lot of passive-aggressive coaching with John Tortorella. And this, to me, is almost like your mom or dad saying, I thought you were ready for it. I don't think you're old enough to handle it. And by him saying, this is my fault. I pushed them too hard. They're not able to handle the fitness level that I want as a coach. I think he's trying to get a message across to his team by taking it on himself publicly, but really lighting a fire under them privately. And I think he's done that in a couple ways already.
Tortorella might be passive-aggressive with players. He has been just plain aggressive with reporters at some points in his previous coaching stops. How has that been so far, the relationship between Tortorella and the press?
Well, it's been great. And honestly, it was fine in Vancouver, his last stop. I think he reached a point in New York where he realized that maybe this was becoming a distraction without benefits. I think there were times, and I still think this is why he does what he does, if there's a story that does not resonate well in the room, Tortorella likes to take it on himself. He calls it protecting his players. And he has before refused to take questions from certain reporters after certain stories that they've written. I think that's to rally the troops behind him. He sort of left that behind. He had very good relationships with the press in Vancouver. He can still be curt. He's an unbelievably fascinating quote. I mean, it's hard to write stories without his presence because he's so eloquent, so articulate. But as in terms of, you know, there's been no blowups yet. Perhaps there will be one day, but that's fine. They happen. It's part of the job.
The Blue Jackets have some games coming up against tough opponents, especially the Capitals and the Kings. They're 2-8 at this point. Is it realistic that they turn it around and make a real shot at the playoffs, or do you think they've dug too deep of a hole?
Well, there's still plenty of time. If you know, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble doing the math right now, but there's also ways you can look at it and say, yeah, okay, you know, there's still plenty of time left. There's still plenty of points out there. I think the biggest thing, and this is perhaps obvious, is they just have to play significantly better. I felt like they took a big step forward in Denver. I felt like they took a half step back in New Jersey. Perhaps that's because of the fatigue. But whatever it is that ails them in their defensive zone, that has to be cleaned up. Bobrovsky looks like he's starting to get his confidence back. But the way that this team plays, when they're that sloppy in their own zone, it puts way too much pressure on the goaltender, and it takes away any sort of offensive pressure you can create whatsoever. Through two periods in New Jersey, they had attempted, not shots on goal, but attempted 10 shots, period. 8 of them on net, 1 was blocked, 1 missed the target. 8 shots on goal in the first two periods. That speaks to how much trouble they had getting out of their defensive zone. They couldn't get started. And that's the part that has to be cleaned up. If they play that way against the Capitals Friday in Washington, it's going to be a massacre.
The Columbus Blue Jackets lost their first 8 games of the season. They've won their last 2 games. They play the Washington Capitals tonight. Aaron Portsline covers the team for the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, thanks again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Despite the things we've been hearing about Ohio State this season, that their quarterback was the wrong one, their offense has looked lackluster, they are 8-0, and they are sitting at number 1 atop the polls.
They are at the very top. Ben Axelrod from Bleacher Report joins us now. Ben, the Buckeyes, right about where they want to be, right? They're undefeated, still the top-ranked team, and they appear to have settled on a quarterback and, maybe most importantly, no major injuries to key players at this point.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think there were some concerns early in the season with some of the sluggish play and the inconsistencies, especially on the offensive side of the ball. But I think with what you've seen from JT Barrett in the last 2 weeks and solidifying himself as this team's starting quarterback, I think you're starting to see a team that's kind of peaking at the right time. They made it out of what's really kind of a slower part of its schedule heading into its bye week. And on the other side of the bye, they have Minnesota, Illinois, and then a couple of major tests in Michigan State and Michigan before a potential Big Ten title game. So the Buckeyes are playing their best ball of the season right now, and it'll be interesting to see if they can maintain that momentum on the other side of the bye week.
You mentioned JT Barrett. He made some news this week with an answer to it seemed to be kind of a harmless question, but he went on to rant for a little bit. When comparing Cardale Jones, the former Ohio State starting quarterback, with JT Barrett, a lot of people compare arm strength, that Cardale's got a cannon of an arm and JT's more of a game manager. But he took offense to that. That he said that he has a strong arm. Can you talk about his response to the question that was asked to him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he was really – I don't think he was knocking Cardale, but I think what he was – saying, and he even admitted Cardale does have a stronger arm than me, but I think what he was saying was everybody expected that when he got back into the lineup or that the reason that Cardale was in the lineup was because it allowed the Buckeyes to throw the ball downfield. And his response was kind of, did you watch me play last year? I made some big plays downfield. Arm strength is not an issue of mine. It might not be as strong as Cardale's, but it's certainly something I can do and something that remained a part of this offense. And the reason you're seeing it missing from the offense this year between both Cardale and JT has more to do with Devin Smith's absence than it does either of the quarterback's arm strength. So, you know, he was out of the starting lineup for about 10 months there, going back to the Michigan injury, the injury in the Michigan game, really 11 months. So I think during that time, you know, he heard some things in the media and from fans that he didn't expect to hear about himself, at least when it came to his arm strength. So you could tell it was something he had pent up and something he wanted to get off his chest. And lo and behold, he did just that with the media on Wednesday.
A lot of people worried about how quarterback Cardale Jones would handle being benched. I know he's still tweeting a lot. Other than that, what's he doing? Is he saying and doing all the right things at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really seen any flare-ups. We haven't seen him change his Twitter bio like he did when he got benched in the Northern Illinois game or anything to that effect. I mean, he's not going to talk to the media anytime soon, just because that's pretty standard procedure when it comes to the backup quarterback. But publicly, I think he's handled it about as well as he possibly could have. It's a tough situation for a kid who could have entered the NFL draft and likely would have been a second or potentially a first round pick. And now his immediate, not only his immediate future, but his long-term future is kind of up in the air in that regard. So I think he's handled it well. We'll see. We still got some time left. And when we get to what could be the Big Ten title game and in a bowl game after that, locker rooms are open. So he will be asked to speak to the media. So we'll kind of see what happens then. But right now, I don't think you can really take any issue with the way he's handled things.
Joey Bosa kind of got off to a slow start this year. He had his one-game suspension against Virginia Tech, and then he was a little lackluster in those first couple games. But the last couple of games he's been out there, he's been lights out. You wrote this week that suspension might have been a blessing in disguise for Joey Bosa.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he got off to a slow start, really. I'll disagree with you there. I think maybe he wasn't tallying the sack numbers that we're used to him getting, but if you watch those games, you'll see that the pockets are usually collapsing where Joey Bosa is rushing the passer, and you were seeing a lot of attention being devoted to Joey Bosa. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Tyquan Lewis has 5.5 sacks and Sam Hubbard has 3.5 sacks. I think that's a direct result of the attention that Joey Bosa has drawn. So I just think we're seeing teams game plan a little differently, and he has 9 quarterback hurries, which is 5 more than he had all of last season. As far as the suspension being a blessing in disguise, that was more about what they call their rush men package, which is when they get their 4 best pass rushers on the field in Bosa and Adolphus Washington and Tyquan Lewis and Sam Hubbard. And that's something they didn't really practice in the preseason. But when Sam Hubbard played as well as he did against Virginia Tech, filling in for Joey Bosa, defensive line coach Larry Johnson figured there was a way they had to keep Sam Hubbard on the field. So that's where they came up with that rushman lineup, which has been really, really effective, not only because of what it does against the passer, but with Bosa and Adolphus Washington playing inside, you don't really leave yourself as susceptible to surprise draw plays or anything like that up the middle. So, you know, the defensive line, I think you have to look at it as the strength of this team right now, and probably the unit of those 9 units that's playing the best right now. And statistically, while his sacks may not be there, I think Joey Bosa is playing just as good, if not better, as he did last year.
Ohio State, one of six undefeated big-time college football programs, along with Baylor, Clemson, LSU, TCU, Michigan State. Baylor just lost their starting quarterback, Seth Russell, for the season. Who else are Ohio State's main competitors? Clemson just blew out Miami. Ohio State has Michigan State coming up. Kind of talk about the landscape of college football. Who appear to be the best teams at this point?
Yeah, I mean, the playoff standings come out for the first time on Monday, and I'll be interested to see how those look. I don't think the Buckeyes are going to be number one if they follow the same criteria that they followed last year. Just in terms of the Buckeyes' resume, isn't all that impressive other than being undefeated. They just don't have those quality wins, mostly because they haven't played those quality teams, and they'll have the opportunity to add those wins to their resume against Michigan State and Michigan. Right now, I think Clemson is probably playing the best of anyone. You saw what they did to Miami last week. LSU is playing pretty well, but they have a big test with Alabama coming up, and I think that game is going to kind of determine who has pole position when it comes to getting that what you would think is the SEC's playoff spot. And then Stanford is a team. They lost in the first week of the season to Northwestern on the road, but is playing as good as anybody right now at this point. They're kind of looking to be this year's Ohio State, where you suffer an early loss and come back and are playing your best ball at the end of the season and crash the playoff at the end. So those are kind of the teams I'm looking at right now. I'm going to be very interested to see how this playoff these playoff standings look come Monday, though.
Five power conferences, four playoff spots. I'm looking at it all, and there's teams from all of these conferences near the top. Which conference, in your opinion, is going to be the Big 12 of last year and could possibly leave out a team for those four spots?
Well, I think until the Big 12 gets a Big 12 title game, I think it's going to be the Big 12, at least all things being equal, where the other four teams have similar records, whether it be undefeated or just one loss. I just think that's such a huge difference, having that conference championship game. It's a whole extra game on a neutral site. I know there was that for some, there was some debate to who was going to get that number four spot at the end, but with the Buckeyes playing in a Big Ten title game, I just didn't think there was going to be any chance for the Buckeyes to be left out in favor of a Big 12 team that only played 12 games when everybody else played 13 games. So, maybe if the Big 12 goes undefeated, whether it be TCU or Baylor, and all the other conferences have one loss or two loss, then maybe they can sneak in. And I mean, the way it's shaping up, you're looking at a situation where the SEC might be the one left out, just in terms of it looks like we're going to have a two loss SEC champion more likely than not. So still early to tell, still a lot of football left to be played. But right now, I think just looking at this thing from the outset, I think you always have to look at that the Big 12 as that odd man out.
Ohio State still clinging to the top spot in the polls. The first playoff rankings come out on Monday, and it will be very interesting to see if OSU can hold on to that top spot. Ben Axelrod from Bleacher Report, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
The Cleveland Cavaliers had a tough ending to the season last year. They were the favorite to win it all for most of the season with the big three, LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, and Kevin Love. Kyrie and Kevin Love both injured in the playoffs last year, and the team lost to Golden State Warriors in the finals. But they're back this year. Kyrie's still on the sideline with a fractured kneecap. Kevin Love appears to be back in full form already, and the team has signed power forward Tristan Thompson to a long-term extension. Here to talk about all those things now is Zach Meisel from The Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Zach, the Cavs lost to a pretty good Bulls team the first game of the season. Then they blew out a pretty bad Minnesota team in the second game. I guess the biggest news of the season so far, LeBron James only scored 12 points against the Timberwolves. How is that even possible?
Well, it happens when you take a big league early, and you don't need 40 minutes from LeBron, and you don't need him to really assert himself. It's so early in the season, and this is, I think we see it more and more each year that LeBron's in the league. And don't forget, he's going to be 31 this year. He's not that 21-year-old spring chicken anymore. So you're going to see him resting more. You're going to see him taking nights off, and you're going to see him trying to get his teammates involved. And when he can have a night where the Cavs lead at halftime greater than 20 points, and he doesn't have to play in the fourth quarter, and he doesn't have to to try to do too much. That's a victory in itself for the Cavs. So he knows that. He's been around the league a long time now, and I think you're going to see more and more of that. I don't think you're going to see LeBron average 28 points a game this year.
For someone who just reads the stat lines in the newspaper the morning after the game, nothing to worry about, right? He looks good?
Yeah, his back has been bothering him, and it's certainly a concern. If you saw in the opener against the Bulls, I mean, every time he was coming out of the game, he was laying down, trying to get some heat on that back just to keep it loose. And it's concerning, but, I mean, he was feeling it last year, and he took 2 weeks off in the middle of the season and came back, seemed rejuvenated, and really was good till the end of the season. So it's something to keep an eye on, but I think that he's been around so long, no one knows how to treat their body better than he does, and he's going to be smart about it. So if you look at the stat line, I think you can see, oh, he only scored 12 points. Well, look, the Cavs won by 100, so it's a good thing that he didn't have to do too much.
Another guy overcoming an injury, power forward Kevin Love, missed the playoffs last year, the end of the playoffs, rather, after a dislocated shoulder. He looks good already, right? He scored 17 against Minnesota, also pulled down 13 rebounds.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting because, remember, the Cavs are playing without Kyrie Irving and without Iman Shumpert for a while, so they need the scoring. It was imperative that they got Mo Williams over the offseason. He can give them some scoring for now in the starting lineup, eventually off the bench, and it's going to be important for Kevin Love to provide that too, because we saw in the finals without Love and without Irving, it was LeBron James, and if anyone else wanted to chip in a bucket at some point, it was welcome. So they need the scoring, and Kevin Love is there to provide it. There were times last year when it was readily apparent that they were trying to figure out how to gel with those three big scorers in the starting lineup, and it didn't really take off until maybe February or March, and so now it'll be interesting with Irving out. Can Love assert himself? Because LeBron is very happy to be a passer and to orchestrate the offense. So if Love wants to be the main guy scoring in the post or on the block, that's a welcome sight for the Cavs.
Kyrie Irving overcoming a really serious fractured kneecap from game one of the NBA Finals last year. What's his timetable? When do they expect him back?
Well, the thing that makes it tough, and in the NBA, it's so different because you have 82 games, and if you watch basketball now, and then you watch basketball again in 7 months when it's the playoffs, yeah, I mean, it's going to be completely different. Guys, you can just tell they're not putting in the same kind of effort right now that they are in March or April. So when you have guys who are recovering from injuries like this, it's going to be a slow process, and they're not going to be motivated to make sure they're back at the end of October. So, you know, there was some talk at first that Irving was going to be out till January. Then there was some talk that he might be ready. He's kept it pretty vague, and it's, you know, he's been practicing some. He's been shooting around. It's tough to get a real read on exactly when he might come back, just because I don't think there's a sense of urgency right now. But he's been around the team, and I don't think it's going to be something that keeps him out past Christmas. But he's certainly not ready to play yet, and I think the Cavs are going to be extremely cautious, especially since he's been pretty injury-prone during his short career.
A guy who the Cavs really leaned on in the playoffs last year in the absence of Kevin Love is Tristan Thompson. He signed a long-term contract. He got a 5-year, $82 million deal. Not quite the max contract that he wanted, but still big money for a guy who really earned it in the playoffs last season.
Yeah, and you look at the Cavs' front court depth now, because remember, Anderson Varejao was hurt last year. They got him back. So you have Varejao, you have Tristan Thompson, Timofey Mozgov, Kevin Love. It's a deep group now, and that's, I mean, you could play LeBron James at the four if you want. Thompson is an important key just because he's young, he's athletic. They need him to do what he does well, and that's grab offensive rebounds, it's getting in someone's way on defense, and it's a big contract. I don't think it's going to look as pricey as it does now in a couple of years when the salary cap explodes and you have role players making somewhere between $10 and $15 million a year. It's a pretty fair deal, and I mean, I'm surprised it took as long as it did to come to fruition. I think both sides benefited from the deal, but the Cavs need him. I mean, it's a blessing that he didn't take the qualifying offer where he could have become a free agent at the end of the year. They'll have him in the fold for a few years now, and that's important. Mozgov's going to hit free agency. Varejao's getting older. They'll have Thompson around for a while, and it's good because I think he meshes well with Kevin Love. He can mesh well with Mozgov. He's he's a force down low, and he's one of those guys where if you're playing the Cavs, Thompson's really annoying, and you don't like playing him. And that's a good thing for Cleveland.
Golden State is still good this year. The Bulls look good. Lots of other teams around the NBA look good. Do you think the Cavs are still a front runner to win the title? Are they the front runner, or where would you put them right now?
Well, I think the benefit for the Cavs is that they play in the East, because outside of the Bulls, I'm not really sure, you know, who's going to stop the Cavs. I mean, it's maybe Miami gets in their way at some point. Atlanta won 60 games last year, but then the Cavs dispatched them in the Eastern Finals. I mean, there's not much of a challenge in the East, and so I think that helps the Cavs, because if you look out West, it could be any number of teams. It could be Golden State, it could be Houston, it could be San Antonio, Oklahoma City, the Clippers. I mean, the West is tough, and it's going to be interesting, but the Cavs won't have to worry about that until the finals, should they make it. So I think the Cavs certainly have to be considered one of the favorites for the NBA championship, and a lot of that has to do with how weak the East is.
The Cleveland Cavaliers have opened a new season, are trying to get back to the NBA Finals. They've split the first two games of the season, and they host Miami tonight inside Quicken Loans Arena. Zach Meisel from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Thanks, Zach.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So it seems a little odd to me, but the World Series is going on as the NBA tips off its regular season. I don't remember those two overlapping before, but they certainly do now. The World Series in full swing, and the Royals up 2-0 over the Mets.
Well, it's the Fall Classic. It's the greatest time to be a baseball fan, even if you're not a fan of the Royals and the Mets.
What if you're an Ohio baseball fan?
If you're an Ohio baseball
painful.
Fan,
it's painful.
But it's still good baseball to watch. Game one was one of the best World Series games I've ever watched, and yes, I stayed up to 1 a.m. to watch the conclusion of that game. It was crazy. There was a bottom of the ninth home run to tie the game, put it into extra innings. The Royals won both their two home games at home, and they head back to New York. They say a series doesn't truly start until you lose a home game or a home team loses a game to an away team, but it looks like the Royals are in the driver's seat to do what they were trying to do last year and win a World Series.
Yeah, the Mets have the better starting pitching of the two teams. The Royals have the better bullpen, which, as we all know, can make the biggest difference in baseball. Royals game one star Edinson Volquez, kind of a Twitter phenomenon, what was going on during that game. His dad passed away just before the game, and no one was really sure if he knew. And so it was fascinating. It was kind of morbid in a sense, but it was fascinating to watch this game. And I don't think he knew. Personally, I don't know. We haven't had confirmation either way, but it doesn't appear to me that he knew at the time. And so it was really interesting to watch.
He was scheduled to start game one for the Royals. His wife had found out that his father had died back in the Dominican Republic, mm-hmm. and opted not to tell Edinson, let him go out there and pitch there. And then as soon as he was taken out of the game, he was informed by Royal staff and he went to be with his family. That is what the Royals are reporting. We don't know if that's the 100% truth or not, but it seems like that is the case, where he did not know going into game one of the World Series. So a lot of that hype going into baseball scene, baseball on Fox, on local channels you can every night, kind of went away.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can find a full archive of episodes using the WOSU Public Media mobile app and also on iTunes.
You can follow us on Twitter, give us a shout out at After the Score. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.